You submitted a number of good questions this evening. We'll get started right on them. First one, how old should children be when we encourage them to be baptized? And of course, the answer is in Acts 19, where Paul baptized them and they were about 12. About 12 people that he baptized. Look at Acts 8 with me, please. Philip goes to Samaria. There would have been babies in Samaria, toddlers in Samaria, children in Samaria. But notice how Luke records the events. Verse 12, when they believed Philip preaching good tidings concerning the kingdom of God in the name of Jesus Christ, they were baptized, both men and women. Baptism is an adult level decision. I don't think that means that children still at home shouldn't be baptized. I believe they should when they're ready and they're convicted and they mean it in their heart. But I don't think that we should be too concerned about trying to get children baptized at an early age. We talked this morning, my guess is to Timothy's age when Paul picked him up, might have been his latter teens or so. Josiah, we see, sought to seek God in 2 Chronicles 36 when he was 16 years old. So teenagers could and should do that. But when we're talking younger children, it is very easy to motivate a younger child to do something. And that doesn't mean that they comprehend the adult level of it. Let me show you something way at the end of the spectrum. In Decatur, Alabama, a number of years ago, I had some friends, and there was they had a pretty little 4 or 5-year-old girl, I guess she was, and some people in the neighborhood said, we're going to be doing some Bible readings at our house, and invited, you know, little children in the community to come over to the house to, you know, hear a Bible story. Okay, so they went. And then they picked their girl up afterwards, and they were pretty disturbed. After they read the Bible story, have you ever seen these child evangelism tracts and such? And it's a little cartoon and a little boy. You know, it's targeted at a small child. And he's trying to get, you know, the boy, other children to ask Jesus into their heart as their personal Savior and stuff. There's a lot of people really into this. And they took this 5-year-old. She said, they took me into the laundry room and turned out the lights and had her pray with them to ask God into her heart. Well, and of course they were able to do that with a little 5-year-old. Which is one reason why we need to be careful about who we let our 5-year-olds around. There's all sorts of predators out there too, which is a whole different issue, but it's easy to manipulate children. And we're not to use the gospel to manipulate children. We're to train them up in the way that they should go. And my feeling on children, I mean, there's, if you're dealing with a Saul of Tarsus and he's a grown man, he's been persecuting the church, and now he's found out that Jesus is not the false prophet, he's actually the Messiah, go ahead and tell him, what are you waiting for? Arise and be baptized. But when you're dealing with a child, I think a better approach is like the apples on an apple tree. You can shake it and get them to fall before they're ripe. Or you can let them come down when they're ready. And I would advise a little bit more of the latter on that, particularly when we're talking about small children. Another similar question. Suppose a girl is very bright. Suppose a girl is very bright, knowledgeable, young girl of 8.5 years of age. She comes to you after Sunday services and says she's afraid to come forward, but wants to be baptized. Well, I had a very similar, and then it says, what advice would you give Susie and her parents, and would you baptize her? I probably wouldn't. And when it was my own little girl, I didn't. And I talked to her about, this is an adult level decision. Now, she was a little bit older than 8.5. But let's remember, Look at Luke chapter 14. Let's look at the type of decision we're talking about. Jesus has a bunch of people following him. And what do we like to do when there's a bunch of people coming? If next Sunday every seat was filled and people were standing along the side here, if that happened at Gettysburg, if that happened here, Jeff might feel the same way I'd feel. I wouldn't want to say anything that would cause them to not be back the next Sunday. I'd try to plan a message that would get them to come back again and again. Well, Jesus is following, he's got a bunch of multitudes following him, and he turns around and he says something that's not designed to get more people to follow him. It's designed pretty much to reduce the number of people following him. Why? Well, picture a large crowd of people following Jesus. Or some of them probably there because they want to deny self and follow him. And they're interested in the words of eternal life. Or some of them there maybe because, you know, they got some bursitis they want taken care of. Or somebody there because maybe they want, like King Herod, see a miracle. And are some of them there because they didn't have anything better to do that afternoon and here's a famous guy coming through town and they want to see what's going on. Or maybe they'll get fed some fish or whatever. He turns around and he says, if any man comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers, yea, in his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Now you know that Matthew's account has, if you love father or mother, son or daughter more than me. It's not an animosity towards your family. It's a no comparison when it comes to where your loyalty is going to have to lie. And he tells us we've got to count the cost. Who's going to start building a tower unless you're sure you're going to finish it? Who's going to go to war unless you're sure you have enough men to finish it? So therefore, whosoever he be of you that does not renounce all that he has can't be my disciple. Now, back up there, one of the things he has to be willing to renounce is his own life. What did James lose in Acts 12? His life. What did Stephen lose in Acts 7? His life. What did Antipas lose in the church at Pergamum? His life. What would Peter lose? His life. What does a Christian have to be willing to lose? If an 8-year-old would like to be baptized but is afraid that people would see them, are they ready to make that kind of a sacrifice before God? Yes?
Can you take a follow-up since I didn't get the right question?
Yes.
But what would you do with a child who is sure that they have sinned? And I've heard this, and they say, well, I know that I sinned against God.
Usually when I talk with children that age, I will, if they're young, I try to kind of talk them out of it. And if they are persistent and persistent and persistent, and their conscience is so convicted that they will meet my objections and insist, then I'm not going to stand in their way, and you know, because there's some real resolution there. And if they later decide, you know, I was young and I didn't know what I was doing, they can correct that later. But if they've really got that resolve and that conviction and they're, you know, really set, there was a girl and boy over in Gettysburg. The girl, I talked to her, and like lots of times they'll say, well, you know, I believe in God and I don't want to go to hell and I've done things wrong. And of course, I've got little Lucas back there and he's 4 years old. He believes in God. And if you ask him if he wanted to go to hell, he would say no. And if you ask him if he's done anything wrong, he'd say yes. And so I'll ask them about children younger than them. And I'll say, you know, does your little brother, because your little brother wants to go to heaven too. Has your little brother ever done anything wrong? Yes. So what's the difference? And if they can't see any difference, oh, yeah. And sometimes I'll point out the difference between, if I go into Walmart and steal something, well, actually, Walmart made a big foolish decision. They changed their policy a few years ago, and they had a lot of stuff stolen over the last couple of years. They were changed something. But a few years ago, if you went to Walmart and you stole something my age, they're calling the police. If I have my 8-year-old go in there and steal something, What are the police going to do? They're going to talk to my 8-year-old and they're going to take me away. And children understand that. And so I talk to them about that sense of responsibility. But if they are determined, you know, if in their conscience, no, they feel that they've really done something wrong and they're old enough to be responsible, then, you know, I want to respect that. And I've baptized them at somewhat early ages. Where did that one go? Oh, yeah. All right, let's move on to the next. Oh, yeah, one passage I wanted to put with that. Look at Mark chapter 8, last verse, verse 38. It says, "Whoever will be ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of him." Paul talked about Timothy making good confession before many witnesses. Now, baptism doesn't have to be in front of a bunch of people. The Ethiopian eunuch, you know, the Ethiopian eunuch didn't say, "Here's water. What does hinder me to be baptized?" Philip doesn't say, "Well, we need to go back to Jerusalem and have a whole bunch of witnesses." But, you know, he's willing to do it in front of his chariot driver, in front of Philip. He's making a decision for Jesus Christ. He's not scared about somebody seeing it. And it's common for good-hearted small children to want to do that, but not have the moral courage ready because they're not that mature yet. And it doesn't mean the same thing to them that it will just a little bit later. All right. Next question. Please address how teens might deal with peer pressure among their worldly friends. Excellent question. Matthew chapter 5. You are the salt of the earth. Verse 14. You are the light of the world. Our teens need to understand their job. Their job is not to fit in with the world. Their job is not to blend in with evil. Their job is not to meld with mediocrity. Their job is not to match nastiness. They are to be a light to the world. You think about the difference between light and darkness. Imagine it gets dark, the lights go out, it's overcast, there's no moon, and it's just pitch black in here. And one person turns on a flashlight. How noticeable will that be? Noticeable. We're going to see that. Now, if we've all got a flashlight, if I turn mine off, you might not notice it's off. Which, there's a little analogy there that's maybe good to remember. We have a habit sometimes, if you think of our light kind of like a Coleman lantern, when we get ready for church, we put on our tie and everything, and, you know, wipe the breakfast off the kids' cheeks and remind them what not to say, and everybody comes in and they turn their flame way up high. And so while we're all here together, everybody's flame is real high. And then we go out into the world, we try to get that flame real low. That's not being the light of the world. Years ago, there was a fella went up to help build the Alaska pipeline, and his friends were concerned because they said the crews up there, they knew there was a lot of drinking and prostitutes and gambling and fighting and hard living. And I said, "That's going to be a really bad environment." He said, "I'll be all right. You know, it's good money. I'll be all right." 6 months later, he came back and they said, "How'd it go?" He said, "I didn't have any problem. They never even found out I was a Christian." So, we need to realize, our teens need to realize, it's not wrong to have friends in the world. Look at Acts chapter 19. Look who warns Paul not to go into the theater. Some of the Asiarchs being Paul's friends, verse 31. He was on friendly term with some of the pagan officials. These Asiarchs would have been responsible, among other things, for various pagan festivities and such. And there would have been some, I don't know if you'd call them borough or city or or imperial what officials, but they're not Christians, but they're on friendly terms with Paul. What do you suppose that meant? Do you suppose there were some things in Paul they respected? Do you suppose that's who Paul hung around with for good times? Because he wanted to enjoy their lifestyle. Probably not that, right? Jesus. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5, when he says, cast the man out of the church that was in sin. He said, I'm not talking about people in the world. You'd have to leave the world to not associate with fornicators, covetous, idolaters in the world. So we're going to associate with those people. And Jesus did. That's one of the things the Pharisees didn't like about him, right? Luke chapter 15, they murmured because he ate with sinners and tax collectors and publicans. But what was the association like? Was it Jesus trying to become like them? Or Jesus offering an example and drawing them to something better? And we're going to come back to this same idea on another question in a few more minutes, so keep that in mind. As is just some practical things, let me just throw out a couple of ideas. Don't be afraid to stand up for your faith. Don't be a wimp about it. Like if the subject of homosexuality comes up and somebody says, what, are you a homophobe? You might say, no, are you a moral phobe? And then, you know, they don't know what that means. Get them to think about it. Say, are you afraid of morals? Well, no. Well, okay, let me explain what some morals are, and you think about whether or not you're afraid of that. In other words, I mean, you can do it politely and friendly, but you can, you know, if we live in a society where certain words are supposed to just make everybody bow over and cringe to, you know, and bow at political correctness. When morals are at stake, don't do that. Stand right up. You know, there's this, if more people would stand up for what they believe, a lot less evil would go on. I heard about a fellow one time, he was at a business speech, and some guest speaker had come in, and he looks, and all the salesmen or whatever are male. He said, okay, since there's no ladies in the audience, I want to tell you a joke. And one fellow said, pardon me, there may be no ladies, but there's at least one gentleman. And then several people appreciated that he said that. And the fellow complimented on it. He said, you know, I've told that at a lot of places. Nobody's done that before. And the fellow respected it. And other people said, I'm glad that you did that. Maybe they even applauded. I can't remember the details or not. Here's the thing. But if he hadn't had the guts to have said it, what would have happened? Half a dozen people would have sat there cringing and feeling uncomfortable and thinking this is not appropriate, but they wouldn't have said anything, and then the punchline, they might have laughed along with everybody else. It takes somebody to stand up and say what's right. If it's your local convenience store, they start taking the brown bags and sticking the magazines out there or something, you know what they should expect to happen? They should expect somebody to come in and say, what do you think you're doing? You know, and stuff. But what if everybody says, well, I don't want to say anything? People react when some things... A friend of mine, he went to the mall, and he was shopping for his girls, wanted to buy him some clothes. And those of you that have girls and have been to the mall, you know the problems with that. And I liked what he did. He walked into the store, he looked around, and he said to the shopkeeper, he said, pardon me, do you have anything other than prostitute clothing? And, you know, I thought that was a pretty good question. One time I was working at a factory in Huntsville, Alabama, and one of the material handlers, I would have been 18, one of the material handlers comes along and he says, hey, Scott! And then he asks a real vulgar sexual question, and he says, you know, do you send such and such? And I could have gone, all sorts of things I could have acted, but what I did, I said, no, I have morals. Anyway, well, I do too. I said, no, you don't, Clyde. I said, you lie. You use foul language. You don't have morals. And he went away. Now, my purpose wasn't just to hurt his feelings. But we, and I could be friendly to him the next day and such, and if he'd want to talk about it, I'd be happy to talk about it. But we need to be willing to not cower and to stand up. Don't give in. Those friends I told you about this morning, and in saying this, you will get too good of an idea about me as a teenager, because there were some major things I needed to change and adjust. But there were some things I was doing right, and my friends would get mad at me about it, as I mentioned this morning, sometimes. And they'd, you know, you're too straight, and you're too strict, you won't do this, you won't do that. But then they would turn around and they would come to me and say, like the fellow I told you about this morning that got so mad, he later talked to me and said, I wish I hadn't slept with that girl. I wish I would have waited until I got married. He didn't tell that to the other guys. He told it to me. Or another friend saying, Scott, I want you to know, I don't drink when I'm alone. If I'm with some other guys and they drink, I might drink just to be like them, but I don't, that's not who I am, basically. He didn't say that to other guys, but he said it to me. So in other words, they'll also, what do they all try to do sometimes? They'll try to get you to be like them. Don't give in. All right, we need to move along here a little quicker. Must every transgression be addressed, or can parents pretend ignorance on occasion and thus pick their battles? Address each transgression and pick your battles. But if it's transgression, it's a battle. You see what I'm saying? Like, for instance, let's say you've just adopted a child and he comes from, you know, I don't know, some far-flung country, and when you sit down at the table, he just, you know, it's just like a mess. Well, you've got several things to address with this child. You might not try to attack everything at once. You might, you know, try to say, don't eat food off other people's plate, and some things like that. For now, don't pick a battle with whether or not his elbows are on the table. You know, sure, pick your battles, but once you make the rule, well, guess now what you need to do. Because if you say, you are not going to do this, and they do it, okay, well, you're not going to do that. You're just inviting testing, pushing, and not taking things seriously. And then the child gets in the mode of, I'm going to see how much I'm going with. I'll push and see how long, and mom will get tired or dad will give up, and you'll have constant battles. So, yeah, pick your battles. Not everything needs to be a battle. When I went down and saw Adam's hair and his beard, I didn't pick a battle with the beard. I don't have a problem with the beard. I had a problem with the hair. I asked him to get a haircut. Pick your battles, but address each transgression. Otherwise, you get in, like Romans 6, if we teach them it's okay to do wrong, then what's to keep them from having the attitude of Romans 6? Shall I go ahead and sin that grace may abound? Or something like that. All right, next question. How do you handle a child that is oversensitive and emotional, crying over nothing? Well, in the first place, to that child, it may not be nothing. And you need to talk to them and find out why it is. And this, most sensitive children are not crying because of this, but please be aware of how many pedophiles there are in our society now. And the internet has only made it worse. And you have children now that are both victims and perpetrators. You 8-year-olds that are victimizing littler kids. All sorts of things going on out there. Got friends that were running a daycare, and there was a 6-year-old using a 3-year-old. And the daycare provider, office or whatever, licensing board or whatever, told him, keep it quiet. How often do you suppose that type of thing happens and the people are told to keep it quiet, and they do? fortunately, this couple didn't. I said, no, you tell everybody that that brings their kids to you, you tell them what happened, you tell them what you're going to do to make sure it doesn't happen again, you get the other child out of there. So sometimes when children are crying, there might be a reason, a serious reason that you need to know about. Other times, it may just be insecurities, and being oversensitive can lead to some other problems later. Exodus International is a site that deals with gender issues. And one thing that sometimes is a precursor to that is just being overly sensitive. Now, we should be sensitive. Now, you stop and think about how many things in the Bible relate to our being sensitive. We need to be able to be pricked in our heart. We need to be able to be cut to the heart. We need to not be calloused. But overly sensitive is a problem. I would say take the time to talk with that child. Find out, say, what's bothering you? You know, why are you so sad today? Get them to talk about it. And if, you know, make sure you get to the bottom of it. And if they're feeling insecure, start doing some things to build up that security. If they're not feeling good about themselves, start doing some things to help them accomplish some things so they'll start feeling better about themselves. And feeling good about themselves, don't give them self-esteem ribbons, you know, for breathing. You know, that's not the way to do things. But help them see what they are good at, and then help them excel in the areas where they're good. And that will start building confidence in them. And you start, you know, build them up, strengthen them. Remember what Paul said in 1 Thessalonians, support the weak and such. Encourage the faint-hearted. Sometimes children are going to be weak or faint-hearted, and they need that. But take the time to talk. And if you get down to the talk and there's no good reason for it, just turn it around into a bit of a game. You know, say, oh, what if mommy and I were like that? You know, I'm just sad because of the cloud and rain. And, you know, you can play a game like that at supper. And then the kids start snickering because it's pretty funny. And, you know, or it's a good way to deal with whining, too. Say, what would it be like if we were the whiners and have everybody go around and whine and the kids think, oh, that'd be terrible. But it becomes funny and it turns that sadness into something else. Find different ways to lift them out of it. All right. How do I prevent my children from becoming secularized if they are in public school for 35 hours a week? Well, that's a challenge. It can be done, but it is a challenge. I choose to homeschool, and as a personal thing, I recommend it. There's a lot of good things about it. There's a few disadvantages to it. There's a lot of good things about it, but you can do a great job and let your child be in public school as well. My niece Amy, Jeff and Libby's oldest daughter, I was really proud of her when she was in high school at age 15 down in the D.C. area. And she was in an advanced placement course, and they gave her just this filthy book to read. It was written by some Marxist sicko, and it was about life in Central America. And he managed to cram corpse abuse, pedophilia, rape, just all sorts of just filth into this book that they're having children read. And she decided, I'm not going to read that book. And she asked for another book to be read. The teacher said, no, you have to read that book. You fail the course. And Jeff and Libby went down and they said, oh, our daughter needs a substitute book. And they said, one of them told him, said, how dare you look over our shoulder? And it became a bit of a thing. And they insisted this is the way it was going to be. And Jeff and Libby let them know, well, sorry, I feel that way. You leave us not much choice. So they went public with it. And it was on the evening news down in D.C. and everything else. And the people on the news said, we would read you what they are requiring high school children to read, but our editorial policies won't let us use that language on the air. Jeff went down and he was handing out flyers outside of the school, you know, saying, you know, would you let your 15-year-old daughter read this? And they came out there and they said, you know, I have the right to distribute this on school grounds. It's required reading material, you know, in my daughter's class. And they acted real stubborn and such, but after they made their stand, then I think they regretted it, because I think the next year, I think the book kind of disappeared off the list, and one time they asked something about Nathan's class, and I said, and they were quite cooperative. But the thing is, there was an established understanding Amy knew. She wasn't there trying to fit in and hoping nobody would mind she was a Christian. She knew who she was, and she took a stand, and the parents were involved. You can do that. A number of you, you know, you're going to public school. If a public school, a parent with a child in public school that is involved with the school, involved in the work, and involved with the child, can do a better job than the homeschool parent who doesn't have them around anybody, but they're not involved in their work, they're not involved with the child, and that type of thing. One of the reasons, lots of times homeschool kids score well, one of the reasons they score well is usually people who take the initiative to homeschool are involved parents. Not every public school parent is an involved parent, but a lot are. And so if you're going to do that, be very involved and let your child know you're going behind enemy lines, basically. And of course, there can be great good done by Christian young people being in those environments to set examples for other people. Let me give you a real quick illustration on this. It ties back into what we were talking about before, Jesus associating with publicans and sinners. He didn't associate with them because Peter and James and John are boring. Boy, those publicans know how to live it up. That's not why Jesus is there. Jesus is there to help them. And if I can give you this analogy, I used to be on a volunteer fire department in South Carolina, and we had two types of SCBA gear. That's your breathing apparatus. It's like scuba, except it's not underwater. And one type had a valve so that when you wanted to breathe in, and you're getting the tank here on the back, because when you go into that burning building, when a sulfur is burning, there's a lot of poison coming off that. Fire isn't what kills people. It's the toxins in the superheated air. You breathe in, you know, air, that really, really hot air in a burning building, it just cooks your lungs from the inside out. And you breathe in toxins, it'll just kill you. Then you're laying there dead, and then the fire burns you. So when firemen go in, it's very important to have this good, clean air on their back that you can breathe that's not, you know, 1,300 degrees or 2,000 degrees or whatever. And so one type was on demand, and you would have to go to get a breath. But then what the Fire Academy or whatever was recommending was to go over to something called positive pressure. Positive pressure, there was no valve that you had to pull in on. It's just always pushing good, clean air there. So that in the event of a seal break or something, you've got a better chance. I had a seal break one time. I ran in, and I was eager to get in there to the fire, and I didn't make sure I got the seal on good. That's a nasty thing. But the idea of positive pressure, have the pressure going this way so that if there's a spot where it's not sealed well, the good stuff is going out instead of the cruddy stuff going in. Analyze your relationships. Teens. If you have some friends and it's not light of the world going out into the darkness, if you don't have positive pressure going, if instead it's darkness seeping in to the light, it's a relationship you don't need. If you're dating a boy, where it's, you know, it's if you're adults, if you're hanging around with people and you're not influencing them, they're influencing you, it's not a good relationship. And I also would highly recommend homeschooling as well. It's one way to avoid some of those type of things for those of you that would be interested in that. What's your opinion with regard to sending your children to a denominational Christian school as an alternative to public school? I've never done that myself. I wouldn't personally be all that thrilled with it. I wouldn't personally object to somebody else doing it. I haven't given it all that much thought. I do know some kids that did that, and I'm sure schools vary one to another. But I know that the family ended up being disappointed on the environment in the religious private school. There was a lot of the same attitudes and stuff there, but that doesn't mean they would all be like. Next question. Is there anything wrong with dance lessons? I would schedule it right after the pickpocket lesson. There's two types of dancing. There's sexual dancing and non-sexual dancing. Exodus chapter 15. What did Miriam and the Israelites' women do after the destruction of the Egyptian army? Exodus 15, verse 20. Miriam the prophetess, Aaron's sister, took a timbrel in her hand, and the women went out after her with timbrels and with dancing. That's rejoicing. Notice who is dancing. The women. Now look at Mark chapter 6. Mark chapter 6, here's another dance. It's Herod's birthday, and Herodias, the daughter of Herodias, came in and danced and pleased them. So he said, ask anything you want. I doubt she was break dancing or tap dancing. Some dancing is sexual. Some dancing is not. I was talking about this with a young man recently, and he kind of didn't see much of a problem with some of this. And one of the other guys said, would you dance that way with me? No! That'd be weird! A minute ago, he said, that's not a sexual thing. Would you do it with a guy? No! Why not? Because it's a sexual thing. You know, our society does some things that just don't make sense. We have compartmentalized behavior. If a woman walked through the grocery store in a little bikini like she wears at the beach, people would be aghast. What are you doing wearing that in public? Whereas she wears it at the beach and everybody's, well, but it's the beach. Dancing's kind of the same way. You know, the office party at the end of the year, people go there, there's your co-workers, your boss, you know, their wives, and you dance with his wife, he dances with your wife, everybody's drinking, kind of flirting, that type of thing, and it's okay because it's the Christmas party, right? You try doing the same thing, you know, in February. You know, walk over to his house and just hold his wife up close to you and be walking around like this and see what he thinks about it. He punches you in the nose. Well, why not do it the other time? There was a girl who wrote to Ann Landers one time. She said, dear Ann, my grandmother's hard of hearing. She had this terrible ordeal. She'd gotten grounded and everything. She said, my boyfriend and I were dancing, but my grandmother's hard of hearing and she couldn't hear the music. She just saw us. And so she didn't realize we were dancing and I got grounded. Does music cancel the erotic, you know, interaction between a guy's body and a girl's body when they're close and cavorting with each other? I don't think so. So, you know, dance lessons, if it's break dancing, that looks kind of cool, you know, but if it's a sexual dance, why teach our children how to do sexual dances? Now, if they want to get married and dance with their spouse, fine. But let them figure that out then. Where do we draw the line with regard to our children's secular entertainment? Let's just read a couple of verses to keep some principles in mind. 1 Peter 1:15. Like as he who called you is holy, be yourselves also holy in all manner of living. Because it is written, you shall be holy, for I am holy. Maybe a good question would be, if Peter was visiting you, would you pop in that movie. You know. Romans chapter 12. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service. Don't be fashioned according to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Paul and Timothy. Paul was an older Jew. Timothy was a younger Greek. Timothy liked athletics. You remember when Paul said to him, bodily exercise profits little. Godliness is profitable for all things. I suspect, I can just kind of imagine them sometimes. You know, they're getting up, and Paul says, okay, let's be going over this Isaiah scroll. And Timothy says, I've really got to get in my, you know, 4-mile run this morning. And, you know, it's nothing wrong with that, but Paul wants Timothy to remember that's not as important as these other things. Nothing wrong with doing things for entertainment, athletics, enjoyment, and such, but be careful about, we live in a culture that's dedicated to entertainment. When has there been a culture so consumed with just instant gratification and constant entertainment? Rome, yeah, and that turned out real well. Yeah, it's bread and circuses, you know, free food and go down and see, you know, watch a rhinoceros trample a midget down at the Colosseum. Is it wrong to use your hand to spank your child? I don't think so. I know the Proverbs talks about rod. I think the point of the text is the discipline being administered more than the vehicle of instrument. It doesn't describe what type of rod to use, which is question number two. What type of rod was the proverb writer referring to? I don't know. Over there you've got in Singapore, you remember when the spoiled American kids spray painted some people's Mercedes and they sentenced them to caning. And our officials got, oh, that's terrible. I thought that's pretty good. You know, they should have, I'd like to bring caning over to America. My mom, she didn't use cane. It was a switch. And, you know, I was told to go out and get it and brought it in and she would apply it. A switch can be used. A belt can be used. Lots of times, especially with a young child, I think they don't need that hard of a spanking. For a little young child, lots of times, give me your hand. You know. And this is just me. I like to kind of involve them in it. I'll let them choose which hand do you want to be on. Or do you want to say you're sorry first or get the spanking first? It psychologically, somehow, it just seems to kind of involve them in it. Makes them part. They realize it's coming. They'll say, spanking first. Okay, and then which hand? And then, you know, lots of times, if that gets the point across, then you don't need to wail them. But if this is not doing it, then you need to step it up. Lucas has had to have it stepped up lately. What type or source of Bible study material would you recommend for a Bible for a family to conduct on for a nightly home Bible study? Oh, excellent book that I would recommend. It's this one right here. In particular, Proverbs. Proverbs is really, really good for a family study. It comes in bite-sized nuggets. You know, you don't have to digest three chapters and get all the connections through it. And so even the younger children can get it and that type of thing, but it's really good for us older people as well. Or start reading through a gospel. Or for something in more detail, working your way through the Sermon on the Mount or something, or going through the history of the Bible, and maybe you can cut out some little cards, make cards that represent a timeline, and cut them out and place them down so that, because sometimes kids have trouble, and adults have trouble sometimes. I was in a study recently with somebody, and, they say, oh, no, Paul wasn't an Israelite. Paul wasn't an Israelite? You know, it's sometimes people just don't have some basic historical concepts down. You can lay down something like that and such. How do I find a balance between encouraging my daughter to pursue a career and being a keeper at home, as Paul told Timothy? There's two choices that a woman can make. In 1 Timothy 5, Paul recommended younger widows to marry and bear children. Doesn't say they have to, but that's what he recommended. He said, I would that they would do that. Keep them from some other troubles. In 1 Corinthians 7, he recommended to the Corinthians to be celibate, particularly because of the coming pressures upon them, as he mentioned in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. I say this, brethren, for the time is short, and henceforth both those that have wives may be as though they had none, and those that weep as though they wept not, etc. I would have you free from cares, and he talks about the advantage of being unmarried. A girl can serve the Lord and never marry and never have children, or a girl can serve the Lord and marry and have children. And if she's going to not marry, she certainly needs to be able to provide for herself. And if she's going to marry, she can help supplement family income, like you see the worthy woman doing in Proverbs 31. That was a very industrious woman, but she's still home-centered. She's not, dedicated to a career out there. What we have really too much, too many times, is that with a career mom, it's not like the worthy woman who's still centered in her home. Too often, you end up with the world gets the first fruits of mom's time. And the family is desirous for the crumbs that fall from the table. Kids need more time than that. A friend of mine was one time talking to a couple, and they had some nice stuff. But they were having a lot of just stress in the home, and they asked him to come over and talk to them about it. And they were saying, we're irritable with each other, because my wife comes home and it's been a long, long day at work, and then I would like supper, but she hasn't had time to really prepare it. And then the kids haven't seen her. They're wanting her attention, but she's real tired and need to get ready for the next thing. There's laundry doing stuff. It's just stress, 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 stress. And my friend said, well, have you considered letting her be here at home? And they said, what? And lose all this? It's good for girls to be able to have things for whether if they don't get married or if it's something that they can do and still be devoted in their home. And there's some things like that, particularly now with a lot of guys now are working part of the week, from the desk at home and such, and it doesn't require being gone as much and such, or for later. But I would say let her know if you're planning to get married, if you're planning to have children, you need to understand where your priority has to lie. Love your husband. Love your children. Be a worker at home. Be dedicated to your family. Like I said, that doesn't mean to outrule any her bringing in income, as you see the worthy woman doing. Should we restrict the amount of personal time our children spend with influential yet worldly relatives? Grandparents, aunts, and uncles. Yes. It's unpleasant to have to warn people about some things that are just disturbing. But a study I was in with a couple of women just a couple of weeks ago, 2-3 weeks ago. Some of you know how much dysfunction is out there. Some of you may be blissfully ignorant of how much dysfunction is out there. It is a sick, sick world and getting sicker. This one woman is the one where her son had threatened to cut a girl's throat and went to school and a razor was found in his pocket. They poured lighter fluid on the carpet in the house, lit it on fire. Her 12-year-old walked up to her and grabbed her breasts. The father just sits and watches porn at home. The And she wants some control of the kids. The father doesn't. He thinks there's no problem and such. The police have been there, I guess, more than once. He tries to pretend there's no problem. It's just horrid what's going on. And her friend who brought her to talk to me, her friend was describing some things she had gone through. She said, when I was a little girl, she had a dirty old uncle. And he would come, and she said, I knew what he wanted to do. He never got to, but I knew what he wanted to do. And he would come in telling filthy jokes and such, and her daddy would never stand up to him because that's my sister's husband. So she was to go lock herself in her room, and they would say, oh, she's got homework. So she has to stay locked in a room while the creep is there. She grows up, marries, has a daughter, doesn't realize that another uncle in her generation, you know, same as her, is molesting her daughter when her daughter's 19. She comes to her mom and says that the uncle has been having relations with her since she was 9. He's now in prison, fortunately. It's a messed up world out there. That's one reason why there should be restrictions on a personal time children spend with influential yet worldly relatives. Some of the grandparents, some of the uncles, some of the aunts, some of the 2 weeks ago, Indiana, the daycare people that were babysitting kids in their home. And then the 3-year-old told the mom about what was going on and it being videotaped and everything. They went in, found the videotapes, everything. Horrible things going on. And that's just some of the reason why. Other things is because some of those people undermine the parents. You drop them off, and the kids know, we're not allowed to watch that. We're not allowed to listen to that. We're not allowed to do that. They say, your mom's not here. Why put your children in the hands of people who are going to intentionally undermine your authority? Be very careful about who you put your kids around. Could you give your thoughts on the influence of TV, movies, etc. on children and our ability to raise them for the Lord? Yeah, it's a lot of filth. And it's getting worse. And the thing is, if we're not careful, we become more and more accustomed to it. But Art showed me something this morning. Do you have that with you, Art?
Yes, sir.
We need to wind up here in just a few minutes, but let me show this. This is amazing. Just to illustrate how quickly things change and we get used to the change, this is a school, public school book. And you know what this is right here? Suggested scripture selections for use in public schools. And here's what scriptures to read in the public school. This is from the 1950s. How long did it take for this to become unbelievable that it even existed? Yeah. Now, the stuff that's on TV now, there was some filth on TV several years ago, but if what was on now had been on then, there would have been a lot of people screaming. It gets worse and worse and worse and worse. How do you handle a child who gets very angry after being spanked? If they're still angry, the job is not done. That may mean they need more spanking. It may mean they need more discussion. It may mean they need more both. If the discipline session has ended and the child hasn't realized that they were wrong, you're not done. Don't say, well, I spanked them. They need to be sorry. Apologies need to be made. If he's angry, you say, are you angry about that? You come here back here right now. So now we're going to talk about this. Do you think you have a right to be angry? Let's go over and review what happened. What does your mother do for you every day? Does she feed you? Does she wash your clothes? Does she help you? Does she take care of you? Does the Bible say that you're supposed to honor your mother? And when she asked you to take out the garbage, what did you say? Have them repeat it. And then they say, was I supposed to tolerate that? You deserve, what do you think you deserve for that? And you go through it with them, help it, and say, why do you think you have a right to be angry? And I would say in a lot of cases, there needs to be another spanking. You know, this is the spanking for what you did. This is the punishment. Or you might make, depending on the scenario, you might make another punishment. This is the penalty, or the loss of privilege, or the spanking, or the fine, or whatever, for your rotten attitude about this. Now I want you to go apologize for getting angry about that. Right, I'm sorry. Mom, I'm sorry. Okay. By the way, fines are a good way to get attention of a 16, 17-year-old. You know, when you tell them things, it's like, remember to do that. You know, okay, and then later, you do that. Oh, I forgot. And they really did. They forgot. You know why they forgot? Because what you said wasn't all that important to them. That's where fines come in pretty well, you know. $10. What? Oh! Now it starts becoming important to them. It's fairly effective. And last, how do you train a child not to whine or nag? Repeating the same question over and over and over. Well, for one thing you say, you will not say that question again. I did this with a mom recently. She had a boy, he was just arguing with her. And I said, explain to him that when you hear him argue, you translate that into the words, I need to go clean some toilets. And so they just, that's the process, you know. So, oh, Mom, why do I have... I believe I just heard you say that you want to go clean the toilet. And just, you know, let them know, you know. And so, or like, when you ask that question again, I'm going to be hearing, I need a spanking. Or, I would like to give Mom $5. You know, and then when they keep doing it, say, oh, you'd like to give Mom $5. Or, oh, you'd like to go clean the bathroom. Thank you very much, you know. And then if they argue about that, oh, you'd like to clean the other one as well. It'll work pretty quick. You be very consistent with your translation ability, and it will work pretty quick. Whining, I really like the whine game on that. Whining to say, oh, what if Mommy did like that? Mom, did you have any problems today? You know, it's supper table. Oh, please, eat meals together. A lot of good happens when you're eating a meal together. The world recognizes that. The child expert and seven in the world, they're really trying, because you know what they've studied and they found? Families that eat together have less problems with drugs and school dropout and stuff like that. It's not a magical thing, but when when people are getting a TV dinner and going sitting in front of the TV and such, and they're not eating, eat together. And during that time, you can do the whining game when somebody's whining. Mom, did you have any problems today? What would it be if Mommy was whining? And she said, I got the electric bill. It was, the rates went up again, and I don't know why they all tried to get some gas, and it was $1.95 last week. Now it's $2.05, and I don't like it. And then, go around the table, let everybody whine, and the kids start, because that's pretty ridiculous. That's pretty funny. And then they don't want to do that. You kind of disempower the whole thing. Same with the crying. You know, if they're really crying a lot, so show them their face in the mirror. Like, ooh, look at that face. And it kind of, or another thing with the crying will be, I'll tell Luke sometimes, I'll just say, do you need to cry another minute? And sometimes he does, since, he's really been hurt or really sad or something. Okay, you can cry another minute. But then when he gets to the stage where it's time to stop, then I give him, say, okay, you can cry for, 30 more seconds. Go ahead. Or you got some more time. Go ahead. I'm done. You're done? Okay. Right. And should teens date at all? you don't have to make the call on that one. In ancient times, a lot of teens got married. My wife was a teen when we married. She was 19. So I'm not going to stand here and say, you know, I was kind of interested in being married to her. But she was 19 and coming up on 20. And she was in some ways more mature than me, so which that didn't take a lot. But I would say it would depend on the maturity of the individual involved and the confidence you have in who they might be going somewhere with. And also, not to just accept the standard. Kids going out and spending a lot of, you know, hour after hour on their own with nobody around is really kind of asking for trouble. Spending some time with your family, with friend's family, with his family or her family, and also having some time to go on a walk or go out to dinner or something, but not just the open-endedness of idleness mixed with hormones that invites a lot of trouble. So use discretion and don't buy into worldly standards. And I believe I hope I didn't miss anybody's question. Thank you very much. Those were a lot of very good questions, and you've listened patiently, and I thank you very much.